Welcome to the Focus on Why podcast. I'm Amy Rowlandson and I ask my guests one simple question. Why? Focusing on the importance of why, I share with you the relatable, uplifting and inspiring conversations I have with people from all walks of life. This podcast will encourage you to focus on your why to enable and empower you to achieve the success you desire. Have a purpose, have a plan, focus on why. Before we start, I would like to draw your attention to what I can offer you as a master coach. I can help you to focus on your why with clarity, uniting your passion with your purpose with a plan to create the life you truly desire. Book a free 20-minute coaching call right now via calendly.com/AmyRowlandson/call, and we can take it from there. Today on Focus on Why, I am joined by Sarah Fox. Sarah, a very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It really is. And what is it that you are focusing on at the moment?
That's a great question, because at the moment I'm focusing on two different things, I think. One is talking about contracts and actually refocusing them to talk about doing deals, because contracts tends to get a bit of a bad reputation. It's a word that puts people on edge. It's not a great seller. But I'm also looking at the fact that in a few weeks' time, I'm going on a 5-month sabbatical and cycling a tandem around Europe.
Wow. Okay. They don't even go together. So we're going to have to deal with these separately. Or maybe they do. I don't know. But I wanted to understand firstly about the contracts and how, yes, the word is not a great seller and it does put people on edge. What is it that puts people on edge about the word, do you think?
I think it's because they just have a bad reputation as not being what they should be, which is a tool to help people do business or to get specialist expertise. They've become over-engineered, over-lawyered. They've focused too much on what happens when things go wrong and not how it looks for things to go right. You know, copy and paste hasn't done us any favours. They're extremely long. So, you know, if you want to share a picture of a cat doing something silly, you could have to look at 6,000 words just to see if you can share that on a social media platform. So we've got an awful lot of very complex, quite gluey words, a bit of word soup, maybe. We've also got them being very one-sided. We've got them that we never get to negotiate them. So that they felt like, you know, a tick box exercise for someone else rather than something positive to build trust, to, you know, build a great relationship, because that's what business is about. It's good relationships. That's pretty much what it should be about. But contracts have got a really bad reputation because they don't do that. They don't have emotional content. They have an emotional impact, but it's the wrong emotional impact as opposed to the right emotional impact. So I've been in UK construction for over 25 years, looked at thousands of contracts, and all of them set my teeth on edge too.
And it is about focusing on something that you have identified as being an issue, identified as there being an easy solution in terms of making it relatable, making it understood from both sides, you know, not being the one-sided that you just mentioned, but also fundamentally what you described is it is a tool to help people to do business, and yet that is so far from where contracts are now at.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I, you know, this came about partly because I was writing and reviewing contracts for clients, but then I was training people on contracts, and they came along to a workshop wanting to know about contracts, but you could tell that they weren't really very happy. They weren't full of the joys of spring, shall we say, when they came in the room. And often when I asked them what contracts said, that they contracts that I thought they should know well, they said, well, I don't really read them. It's like, so, okay, so nobody reads them. That means nobody knows whether they understand them. We know that most people don't understand them because the data shows that they don't, which means basically we're creating long bits of word soup that nobody actually ever wants. What a waste of everyone's time, energy, effort and emotional, you know, energy. It seemed bonkers to me.
And something that's just popped up, when you say nobody reads them, yet we sign them. And we sign away so many things yep. on a daily basis without having read them.
Yep.
So I'm thinking about the T's and C's that you sign for your phone apps, your applications such as the social media platforms that you're on. And I'm just thinking about what are the implications of not reading, not understanding, yet signing?
Well, the implications are that we're basically going into it all a bit blindfolded. You know, I've read some of the social media platform T's and C's, and I did a short version of the Twitter terms and conditions, taking it down from 6,000 words to 3 tweets. And it was clear that there were an awful lot of terms in there that I wasn't expecting, things like they owned my copyright in my images. So if I uploaded a photo of a cat, they could take it. They could sell it to media if it was interesting. And I thought, well, hang on, that's not what I'm expecting. I'm expecting to get adverts. I'm expecting for them to be able to share it. I'm expecting them to say we can't guarantee Twitter will always be available. But I'm not expecting them to say, and by the way, once you've posted it, it's ours. And it all just struck me that I don't know what other terms might be in other social media platforms. So I'm not quite sure whether, and I think this has become more apparent, that I'm the product, not an actual user. So I think the problem we've got is, I know there's been kind of comedy experiments where people have put in joke clauses in terms and conditions, ones to do with selling your oldest child or, you know, having a birthday cake. All these kind of joke things get slipped in just to see how many people spot them. But there's an awful lot of stuff which isn't jokes that's being slipped into these terms and conditions, which kind of make it really difficult for us to feel that there's any sort of balance, there's any sort of, you know, deal going on here that makes sense for us as consumers or as business owners.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the latest Black Mirror a season. There was an episode there that was really relating to the social media area of what they had signed and then not understood. And it was using identity. It was using their whole identity in essence and making a new version of that person and giving words to your voice. I get how the evolution of media, of communication is evolving and it's becoming really intelligent. But we need to still take responsibility and own our own intelligence, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in that role of focusing on doing deals, on helping people to understand how they can better use their time and energy, what are the results? What have you created for people?
So one of the first things I created, I was challenged to do this by my twin sister, was a 500-word contract to see whether it could be done. That's why my business is called 500 Words. And for me, it was an exercise in what's a bare minimum you need to create a deal between two parties. And it's interesting because the bare minimum you need for pretty much any deal is learning how much you're going to get paid and what you're going to provide. Once you've got that, in English law, you've got the basics of a contract. But most contracts don't just have that degree of scarcity. They're not that bare bones. So then it was looking at the other things that I thought were needed, that were essential to create that balance, to make it fair, to make it workable. So I created a 500 contract, actually mostly as a training tool. But when I started introducing it in training events, people said, oh, I really like this idea. Ours have got really complicated. Maybe we could adapt this. And that's where it started to get a life of its own. But also as part of that, it was an acknowledgement that if you've got something really simple that's really, that reflects your values as a business, it reflects balance, that is easy to read, you can give it to people really early on rather than waiting until you've built a relationship and then surprising them with a set of terms and conditions. You can do it on your website. You can do it in your proposals. You can do it the minute somebody first contacts. You can say, oh, by the way, if you do want to do business with us, this is what it looks like because these are our terms. And then we can stop it being a sort of kind of sticking plaster towards the end of the relationship, somewhere in the middle, or, you know, a barrier to doing business. We can just make it a seamless part of all that sales and marketing and getting to know people, you know, the know, like and trust. We can get it in early so we can build the trust rather than being scared that it's going to damage a nice relationship. We can get it in early. We can use it as a positive tool to say, this is what we mean. What about doing business with us? This is how we deal with complaints. This is the guarantees that you've got about our experience. These are the things that we're telling you are in our terms, because that shows that we're good at our job. We've done this before. We know what to expect. We're giving you some tips as well as part of that contracting process. So it's not just about content. It's about also having a really simple process, but also treating it as part of your whole marketing of your business. Because, you know, marketing is about what people say about you. And if they loved you until they saw your contract, that's still a big but. If they love you, including your contract, then they love you. You know, there's no ifs and buts in that one. So I've kind of started looking at it as a kind of more holistic approach, rather than it just being me being a lawyer going, oh, I think you could simplify this. So let's also think about how we bring in your values as a business. So to give you an example, I was working with a company who's a cleaning company, and during pandemic, they got an awful lot of work because there was a lot of cleaning to be done. And one of their business values is to pay the real living wage. So we put in their terms that there would be an annual increase in their prices every single year because they want to pay the real living wage. They'll let their clients know, and if they don't want to pay that increase, then they don't have to renew their contract. But it wasn't like this is optional, we might increase. It's like the real living wage increases every single year. We have to reflect that in our prices. So they really owned what was important to them as a business, and they weren't scared to put it in their terms with new clients, new suppliers and all that kind of stuff. And I know when I first started my business, I always used to check what people's websites said and used some of the wording in their contracts. And I was surprised a number of times people said to me, oh, you can't put that in there. I said, well, it says that on your website. And they're going, oh, does it? So they didn't know what the website said, but also they weren't looking at it from the point of view of somebody who was interested in doing business with them. They've looked at their website and they've seen these promises. They want those promises reflected throughout their dealings with that company. So I've kind of tried to knit it all together, because I think for me, that makes it the kind of the smoothest way of doing business. And I mean smooth in a nice way, not in a slightly slick way.
And what I'm hearing, Sarah, through the telling of the story, but also the articulation of what you're focusing on here, is balance, fairness, professionalism, excellence, positivity, trust, professionalism, clarity. You spoke about values. I'm hearing those, but do you have specific values that you've identified yourself?
Yeah, I have. And trust was a big one. I read The Speed of Trust about, I don't know, 15 years ago, and was fascinated in how all of the issues in The Speed of Trust would relate to doing business, and got in touch with a couple of the companies. In fact, Stephen Covey put me in touch with them, because as a result of a bizarre series of coincidences, he ended up speaking to me about trust. So trust is really important, and empowerment. I'm really interested in making sure that I'm not giving a business a tool which they then have to keep coming back to me to ask questions about. I don't want to build myself into their business. I want to give them the tools to do it themselves, to be able to read it, to understand it, to adapt it, for their clients to be able to ask questions and for them to have the answers, rather than going, actually, I don't know what that clause says. And we had a lot of this in the pandemic, where force majeure, lots of people were asking about force majeure. It's like, why is it in your contract if you don't understand it? But they didn't, because some lawyer had put it in, told them they ought to have it. And simplicity, obviously, is part of my whole business ethos and my values.
Yeah, I love that. And with the empowerment, I'm also hearing autonomy and responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because too many people have a contract, but they've kind of delegated it to someone else, someone clever or someone legal or whatever they thought. And it's like, well, I think this is about your relationships and you can't really delegate your relationships to someone else because you've got to be there. You've got to be part of that relationship. And I didn't want legal to be in a box on a shelf. I wanted it to be a core part of people's business relationships. So it was really important to me that people felt that they could take control, that they understood it. And I, when I send a contract out, I say, look, I'm not going to explain what it says because I want you to understand it. If you don't understand it, then I've not done my job.
Yeah, I love that. You did a bit of a name drop. I can't let it go. I want to know a little bit more about how you had a conversation with Stephen Covey.
I think I was reading Speed of Trust on Kindle. And he made some comment about the Moravian data on 97% of our meaning, or 93%, whichever one it was. And I hadn't spotted that there was a footnote. And I tweeted about this and said, oh, Stephen Covey, I thought he was better than this, and made some, you know, polite-ish, but, you know, sarcastic comment. He was fairly new to Twitter. He ended up getting somebody to speak to me. They'd seen my website. They'd seen that trust was part of my business sort of values. So he ended up chatting to me about trust, and I asked him some questions about people he'd referred to in his book. He put me in touch and I did a couple of case studies with them. So it was just a complete serendipitous series of coincidences. Probably the best tweet I've ever had.
Yeah, I love it. And oh my goodness, how annoying is it that that has been misrepresented, that piece of research, more than anything else?
Absolutely. And he hadn't misrepresented it because he had in fact commented about, you know, it in the footnotes. But, you know, footnotes are right at the back. Nobody reads a footnotes on a Kindle, and I certainly didn't. So I had to eat a little bit of humble pie, to be quite honest, but I was quite happy to eat humble pie with Mr. Covey.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, because it actually links in really well with your work, the contract. It wasn't there in the body of the main work. And so it then doesn't get seen. It doesn't get read in the way that it's needed to be read. So it does link in nicely.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about this 5 month sabbatical. And I guess the question is, how does it, if it does at all, link in with your work?
Well, I think the interesting thing about a tandem is it's so much about trust. Because we first hired a tandem over 25 years ago. And the geometry of a tandem means the tall person has to be on the front, and I'm at least a foot smaller than my husband, so he's always on the front. I can't really see very much. I can't steer. I can't control the gears. I can't see where we're going. I can't make any decisions, really. I just have to trust that he has my best interests at heart when we're cycling together, and that he's got me in mind whenever he's doing things, because he can't see me either. So I'm behind him. I could be doing anything. There's a big misconception about tandems that if I don't pedal, he won't know. And that's complete rubbish. Because we have what's known as a timing chain. So I can feel exactly how much pressure he's putting through his pedals. So I know when he's really concentrating on a bit of map reading, because his pressure comes off just slightly. And he knows when I'm taking a photograph on the back, because the pressure comes off just slightly. So apart from that tiny bit of through the foot information, that's it. So it's very much like this kind of contractual scenario where somebody's got all the information, somebody else is helping them, and they're not unequal partners. You know, the tandem doesn't work with one person on it. We have to be doing it with the same kind of feeling that we're going in the same direction. And we want to be going in the same direction. That's, you know, key, because you can't really cut it in half and go in separate directions. It certainly doesn't work like that. So there is that kind of analogy between business. We think we're independent. I mean, I'm an independent adult. I could, if I choose, get off and stop, but that stops the journey. So that's kind of the nuclear option, I suppose you would say, for tandem cycling. But I think the other thing, because we're doing sort of 15 countries around Europe, I'm quite interested to see how, and we'll be staying virtually in different places every single night. So that's like 200 lots of accommodation. I'm quite interested to see how the contractual thing turns up with those bookings, and when you turn up at a hotel reception, how they deal with that difficult bit, particularly because in only France and Italy do I speak enough of the language to be able to understand anything they give me in their language. When it comes to Albania and Kosovo, I'm going to be out of my depth. So I'm quite interested in how that works. It's not the focus of my journey, but I will be just, you know, picking up a few things as we go to see how that changes from country to country and even within countries.
And what was the inspiration behind the journey?
Do you know what? I think it's lost in the mists of time. For our 40th birthdays, I've got a twin sister and both our husbands were born in the same year. So when we were 40, we all went to Istanbul. And at one point, sometime after that, I think we said, when the kids are all grown, we could cycle the tandem to Istanbul. And originally that had been the plan. So up until about 6 months ago, that had been the plan to cycle the tandem to Istanbul. The difficulty with the tandem is you can't put it on a plane. Most planes won't take it because it's too big. You can't put it on a train. So getting it back was proving to be a bit of a logistical nightmare. But also because of the heat in Europe in the summer, we realised that actually heading further and further south during the summer was going to get to the point where it would be impossible to cycle during daylight hours. And I'm not much good at nighttime. I know some people could drive during the night, but my brain just switches off. So I'm out. So we've ended up doing sort of part of the route to Albania and then heading back to the UK instead of going on to Istanbul.
It's amazing. And it is interesting how a seed has been planted and it's just sat there and it's now come to fruition, which is fab.
And in some respects, the pandemic did us a massive favour because we spent a lot of time on our tandem during the pandemic because it was the one thing we were allowed to do. And where we were in the UK, there weren't any restrictions, specific legal restrictions on how long you could be out. Although everyone talked about a recommended hour, we would go out literally all weekend on our tandem, sometimes with our kids in tow, sometimes not. So we did a lot of miles. We got a lot more confidence in each other because we did about 5,000 miles during the two lockdown years. We then took it to the Swiss Alps and the French Alps and realised that we could make the big passes that we would need to go over to do this tour. So bit by bit, our confidence in each other has grown. And I think that's also, it's very relevant to working in business. Because you start with something small and you kind of have to build confidence. Sometimes you have to build it very quickly. So on a construction project, for example, you may be doing multi-million pounds of bits of work. So you have to kind of create that confidence quite quickly, which is a bit unrealistic, kind of has to happen because it doesn't really work any other way. So I think our confidence has grown and I think the way we've worked together has grown over this time. And it was really interesting because I put a post on LinkedIn not so long ago saying that when we first got together, lots of people would say, she's not pushing at the back. And I used to say, I bet they wouldn't say this if I wasn't a woman. And my husband would kind of dismiss it slightly. And eventually during lockdown, he heard it so many times from lots of different cyclists, from pedestrians, from car drivers would shout out their windows about it. I mean, it was just tedious. Eventually, he just said, no, she's my rocket. She is the engine on this bike. And that really helped because he wasn't saying it doesn't matter because it mattered to me that people were saying that because I knew that I was pushing. I was pushing just as hard as he was. So it was really interesting that the dynamic has changed where he's got my back and I've got his back as well.
I feel like you should have T-shirts put on for your trip.
Yeah, I don't think matchy-matchy is the way we're going.
No, well, they can be different. It's like, I'm pedaling, she's pushing, we're pushing the same, like whatever it needs to be saying. No, I am joking, but...
It's all right. The people we bought our tandem from who made it, so they're down in Telford and refurbished it actually in 2019, just before lockdown. They had on the wall, there was somebody taking a tandem on the Land's End to John O'Groats, and they were being sponsored for every time somebody said she's not pushing to them. I thought, well, might as well make a positive out of it.
I totally agree. And it's not a charity cycle, is it? Or is it?
No. And to be honest, we're not doing it for anyone but ourselves. So people keep saying, will you be posting regularly about it? It's like, we just want to do the cycle. Hmm. So if we happen to post, which we probably will, that's great, but I don't want to be obliged every week or daily or whatever to tell other people what it's like. We're going to go through some rough times. We're going to have some, you know, mechanicals probably. We're going to feel poorly. We're going to have floods or heat waves or whatever. We don't know what's coming. We've got 5 months to find out. But we're just going to try and take it as it comes. Now, I'm quite an organized sort of person. So for me, it's a bit of a step into the unknown. Of course, I've got a business. So it's also a step into the unknown to leave my business for 5 months and hope that when I get back, it'll still be there. But, you know, we've decided now is the right time. Our kids have gone to university or moved into jobs, but they haven't got married. There aren't kids on the way. My in-laws are still in pretty good health. Neither of my parents are alive anymore. So we've kind of got a window where it feels like this is the earliest time we could have done it. And let's do it early because, well, we don't know what the future holds. And we wanted to, you know, seize the day, so to speak, while we could.
So you mentioned you just are a bit of a planner. You have got a huge amount of clarity about the work you're doing and this venture you're about to embark on. How does purpose weave into your world?
I didn't want to set up my business. When I set it up, I'd been a lawyer. I, you know, recorded my time in 6 minute intervals for 20 years. I trained people. I didn't want to just do the same old, same old. I didn't want to be following the corporate approach. I tried to bring the whole of myself into corporate law when I'd worked in a big law firm, and they weren't that interested. I know years ago I suggested, why don't we turn all our documents, our client-facing documents, into crystal-marked documents? That's a plain English campaign sort of badge for documents that they consider to be simple. And they said, oh, you know, clients don't really want it. And then I said, you know, why don't we use spreadsheets for estimating costs? And said, well, lawyers aren't really very good at spreadsheets. And I remember kind of coming up with ideas to do with process or to do with business improvement. And at the time, they weren't really very interested. It was kind of same old, same old. It's worked before. Let's do it again. So when I started my business, I was really interested in just doing things slightly differently and think and doing it for a reason, not just doing it to make money. And I didn't have big financial goals when I set my business up at all. I think when I set my business up, I had 3 kids from 4 till 9. And I just said, I just wanted to make enough money to pay for their after school clubs, their music lessons, you know, the kind of fripperies of life. I didn't have big plans. Of course, things have happened in the meantime since my business has grown, but I really wanted to make sure that people had the ability to get access to legal assistance from all different types of businesses. So, you know, I work with a lot of sustainability organizations who are involved with retrofitting homes because that really matters to me. The environment and sustainability really matters to me. So I've kind of seed through purpose by picking the projects I want to do. And I have kicked projects out where people have said, will you help? And it doesn't interest me. It's not about whether I've got the skills. This is a project that doesn't meet my personal values, so I'm not going to get stuck in. But I've also followed maybe channels or projects which haven't actually made any money, but I've just sparked an interest that have helped me to understand a different perspective or looked at legal design or looked at information design or creativity or technology in law. And that's been really helpful just to be able to have a bit of a play, really.
Yeah, I love that. So play, you just mentioned just then, is for me a really key part of living and purpose. How else does play feature for you?
Oh, well, one of my, so on the wall behind my computer, I've got my vision, which basically says, I want the freedom to be active, have fun and go on adventures. So I think quite a lot of that is play. Having fun doesn't have to be paid fun or unpaid fun. Adventures don't have to be paid or unpaid. I want to speak internationally, and I have spoken internationally. A lot of it was virtual because I chose 2020 to go and become an international speaker. Timing was everything. But I think, you know, I think that feeds through all of my paid and unpaid play. I like to be outdoors a lot. I know I'm going to be outdoors a lot in the next 5 months, but I like to be outdoors even when I'm working. I like to be outdoors and be experiencing the world and all the different types of people in it and all the different things I could see, hear, smell, taste and do. So for me, a day without play is a day when I've got to be really, really poorly.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you are expecting various obstacles to come in your way, whether they be weather related or technical related on your trip. Have you got room for flexibility? Have you got every night planned, or is it a case of you've got some leeway for not making a particular hotel one day?
Yeah, so we've got a map of the route, which really is looking at how far between beds, really, because some places we're going to in the world are fairly remote. So we looked at it, and also because of Brexit, bless it, we've only got 90 days in the Schengen area. So we had to make sure that we could plot a route that had 90 days. We've ended up going over that. So we got visas for France. So we've done quite a lot of plotting just to make sure that it was feasible, that we could do it in 5 months, that we could go to the places that we picked, whether they're World Heritage sites or people we knew or just places that had always fascinated us. So we've been quite sensible plotting it, but we've also put plenty of rest days in. So we've got quite a lot of rest days built in. We've got quite wiggly routes so that we know that we've got shortcuts that we need to take if we need to take them. So there's all sorts of things have been put in. We've got a spreadsheet. We've also got lots of backup plans. We're going to really only pick accommodation a couple of days in advance until we get to the peak summer holiday, when we'll be doing it a little bit. But by then, we'll have been on the bikes for 2.5 months. We'll have a much better idea of actually how far we're going to cycle. So we've done a practice cycle fully laden last year in the Massif Central, which was just so much fun. So we're both quite excited that this could be roughly that amount of fun again. But, you know, neither of us have spent 5 months, my face really close to his back for 8 hours a day. So, you know, there's still a little bit of sorting out to do. But yeah.
What did you learn from your practice cycle about yourself?
Oh, we learnt that spending time with French people in their homes and eating with them was just one of the most an amazing blessing, because both of us speak good enough French that we were speaking to them in French. And as a result of that, the country that we're next spending the most time in is Italy. So I've spent, since we got back from that holiday, learning Italian through a series of tutors, podcasts, books, videos. I've gone all out to try and get it to the point where I can have conversations in maybe not the best grammar Italian, but using all the vocabulary that I've learned, because we found that to be such an amazing experience, talking to people who were hosting us for the evening and just chatting to them and their, you know, fabulous backgrounds. You know, you learn about someone so much in a couple of hours over a nice ragu or over a nice meal. It was just a real blessing to meet such amazing people. So yeah, that's something that I think surprised me more, because I'm a bit of a home girl, to be honest, Amy. So, you know, the idea of moving on every night, I thought was going to freak me out slightly. But we got into such a routine. We met such amazing people, went to such amazing places that actually it wasn't a bore or a chore. It was just a pleasure and a privilege.
Mm. And you just triggered a thought here that Dan Buettner, who talks about blue zones, and he's got many Guinness World Records from cycling across the planet. That's how he started all those many years ago. And essentially what he's going around is to find out the secret of prolonged life, of a yeah. longer life, and all of those things. And I'm just wondering, you just spoke about the enriched experience that you have of communicating with people from all different places and being able to have these conversations and understand more about the culture. It comes back right back again to relationships, which is where the conversation started today.
Yeah, Absolutely, absolutely. And some of the conversations we had in France will stay with me probably for the rest of my life. So, you know, I know that we'll have so many more. And one of the things a friend of mine who is a podcast person has suggested that I take a microphone and maybe record some of those conversations, or at least record a diary entry rather than having to write it down and then carry it with me. But just so that I've got an in the moment snippet of a particular day or a particular time on a particular day. And I quite like that idea because I think there's a richness in audio that there isn't in the written word.
Absolutely. And I've listened to various other people recording their Camino walks, for example, Camino de Santiago, and those experiences of hearing the sounds, the birds in the background, or the bell tolling, or the sea crashing, whatever that is, the audio is so evocative because it allows the individual to play their own movie of their own life. Yeah. But you provide the soundtrack for it, which is lovely. And I think it's a great idea, Sarah. Even if you took it, recorded it, never used it, you've got it. If you didn't, then, you know, that would be a shame.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing it at one point, I'm sure. And you probably don't even know some of the learnings that are going to come off this trip.
No, completely, completely. And it's interesting because our kids are sort of, one of them's about to finish uni, one's just started. And I was talking about the fact we live in a house that was a good size for a family of five. I said, well, you know, what are we going to do with the house? And my husband said, we're not making any major decisions until we come back because we don't know how it will change us. We only know that it will change us.
Yeah. I love that. Well, open to change.
Yeah.
Great mindset. Fabulous. Sarah, thank you. And I'd love to be able to share with the audience how they can get in contact with you. What's the best way for doing that?
Well, probably by the time this comes out, the best way to get in contact with me will be through LinkedIn, because that's be one thing that I will be paying attention to. I basically, everything else will be get back to me in September. But you know, if people want to get in touch, please do. I will get back to you when it's convenient for me to do so. But I'm also got a website, 500words.co.uk. So you can find me there and look at the resources I've got for people who want to learn how to build better relationships. Whether you call that through contracts or through other means, building better business relationships is what I want everyone to do.
Oh, I absolutely love that. And all of those links are in the show notes. So go there. And the podcast longevity is such that this could be several years down the line that someone comes to listen to this. So we're talking about 2024 here. So just to put a little bit of a reference point in, Sarah could have been now on embarking on her fifth or sixth trip by the time you listen to this. So yes, watch this space. The tandem is ready. Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your focus on why. It really has been a delight. Have you got some final words, please?
Well, my final tips would be not to let the word contract or terms and conditions or agreement put you off taking control of how you build relationships in your business. Make sure that it sounds like you, it feels like you, and you're comfortable with it, because then you won't feel embarrassed to share it with the people who you need to help you grow your business. So just take a step back and think about how you would like to run your business and find someone who can help you do that.
How has this conversation had an impact on you? What value have you received from tuning in? What are your reflections with actions? Please take a moment to leave me an Apple Podcast or Spotify review sharing how Focus on Why has made a difference to you today. Remember, the conversation doesn't end here. To keep it going, simply connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook or Twitter, or join the Focus on Why Facebook group. All the links are in the show notes. Have a purpose, have a plan, focus on why.